And we talk tonight about our universe and how we are learning more and more about it. And we talk about that with two universe knowers. They are Timothy Ferris and Jim Manning. Timothy Ferris, an old friend who's been here a number of times over the years, is a very well-known science journalist, really an astronomy, astrophysics, cosmology journalist, who's done a number of fine films, some of which you've surely seen, and a new one coming up, Seeing in the Dark, about which we'll talk. He's also been on and off various campuses or campi. He is now professor emeritus at UC Berkeley. Jim Manning is the executive director of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. Does that mean that you do all your observations from a boat just off Los Angeles, or what?
Absolutely not. The name is an artifact of our founding back in 1889. Actually, we are an international organization and cover the whole country, coast to coast.
I want to give you a few quotations for you to react to. All of these have to do with the universe and our knowledge of it or our getting to know it. Roger Penrose, the great scientist, essentially neuroscientist, said, "Consciousness is the phenomenon whereby the universe's very existence is made known." Steve Wright said, "Black holes are where God divided by zero." But he's a stand-up comic. We'll put him aside for the moment. Bill Watterson said, "The surest sign that intelligent life exists elsewhere in the universe is that it has never tried to contact us." Which one would you choose, Tim Ferris, to elaborate upon?
Well, the first one seems to be circular, doesn't it? Since consciousness, by definition, is to know something. And so our observing events in the universe means that they're known. And naturally, we wonder how many other entities have observed events. Even if you think about something as simple as light, you know, imagine that you're out in space. You're looking at the blackness of space. Light can be passed. You could be in orbit around the sun. Light's flooding past you, and yet you don't see any of it until you hold your hand in front of your face, and suddenly your hand is illuminated, and by that interaction, you know that the light is there.
I've got an experiment in time travel I have suddenly conceived, and I want to get the two of you to play along. Imagine we're at this radio station during the first year of its existence, which is 1925. And you are who you are, but you're back in time. You started your careers that many years earlier, and we're talking about what we know about the universe. What, in 1925, do we, in fact, Jim Manning, know about the universe?
Not nearly as much as we know today. That was around the time of the famous Harlow-Shapley Heber Curtis debate about whether the spiral nebulae that people saw in telescopes was actually, were actually within our own galaxy or were separate island universes. Wasn't that 1924, actually, Tim, around in that era?
Yes, astronomers were seeing these fuzzy nebulae, nebulae just being the Latin word for fuzzy, and some of them had spiral shape and looked like planetary systems condensing, and until their distances could be determined, that was a great subject of debate.
Did we yet know in 1925 that there were other galaxies?
Not exactly. That really came about with in the 20s with the discovery of a class of stars that could be used to measure distance that could then, with bigger telescopes, be identified in other galaxies. Really, telescopes that drove it. A lot of the history of science is much more driven by technology than people think, and I imagine that's because historians are often brought up to think of history, intellectual history, as being great thinkers coming up with ideas. But the history of science is at least equally a matter of capable scientists getting good equipment in their hands.
How does Hubble open up the universe for us? I know he's a crucial figure. That's one of the reasons we've named that space telescope for him.
Absolutely. Hubble was the person who said the universe is expanding. The universe is made up of island universes, of which the our Milky Way galaxy was one.
When did he say that, by the way?
That, again, is in the I forget the exact year. It's late 20s, I believe.
Yeah. In 1929, yeah. The first paper was published.
So in 25, we still would not have been at all certain that there was an expanding universe and that there were other galaxies out there.
In cosmological terms, as late as 1925, we were still almost as provincial, say, as your average European was in the year 1000 AD, when if you interviewed your average European, he or she would not know anything of the world beyond the next couple of villages. They never would have seen the ocean. They wouldn't know about the Alps. All that's where we were. We knew that the Earth was a planet. We knew there were some other stars as well as the sun. Beyond that, we knew little of the architecture of the universe. So if we'd sent a message out with that first broadcast day at WGN, we'd be a little embarrassed.
By the way, we did. That is to say, all radio signals are still traveling through space, are they not?
That's true. So those signals are out now a radius of 85 light years. And that encompasses many hundreds of stars.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's anyone listening out there with a cat's whisker, they can pick up those what are now to us signals from the past.
Now, the immediate occasion for our doing this program and for the two of you being in town for a meeting that begins tomorrow is that we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of yet another way of getting into space, and that's the Voyager. Do we call them satellites? No, we don't. What?
Spacecraft.
They're spacecraft. They're space explorers.
They're interstellar spaceships.
Yeah, and they're out there. Approaching the outer limit of our solar system, aren't they?
Right. The heliopause. The hope is that their last great contribution to science will be to announce to all of us back here on Earth where the sun's heliopause is, where its influence stops and that of interstellar space begins.
Its influence in the sense of gravitational pull?
In the sense of solar wind.
Every star blows off its outer atmosphere constantly at supersonic velocities. But eventually it runs into the interstellar medium, which is thin, but it is out there, and it's brought to a halt. So every star is surrounded by a teardrop-shaped bubble. And that bubble is what, as Jim says, the heliosphere.
It's a wonderful term, heliopause.
The heliopause is the inner edge of the heliosphere. We don't know how thick it is. That's one of the things Voyager will measure. So Voyager 1 launched 30 years ago this Wednesday. If it survives a few more years and it's healthy now, should succeed in mapping that bubble around the sun and then entering into interstellar space where it will wander among the stars of our galaxy forever.
Now you, of course, as I need to remind you, Timothy, or maybe you in fact fully remember this, you had a great deal to do with designing material that went along on Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 just in case some other extraterrestrial creatures eventually picked up those explorer objects, and this would acquaint them what was on those golden disks, would acquaint them with who we were.
A little background. The astronomers Carl Sagan and Frank Drake put a plaque on the first space probe to leave the solar system entirely. The Voyagers are actually further away now because they're moving faster. And then with the Voyager mission coming up, what happens is these spacecraft, when they pass the planet Jupiter, they get accelerated to such a velocity that they're hurled out of the solar system.
They realize like they're playing Hi-Li.
Yeah.
Just come out of the...
Yes, that's right. It's a good way to put it.
The gizmo,
it. They realize that for the same weight of having a plaque that showed a little rudimentary information about who we are and where we are, that you could make a record. You could etch the grooves of a record, which is a very good way to preserve information. So each of these two twin Voyager interstellar spacecraft has a gold record on it, which contains 90 minutes of music, photographs, natural sounds of Earth, things that are intended to inform someone someday a little more about us than you could infer just from looking at the spacecraft itself.
And we could assume that anyone in an opposite spacecraft from some other galaxy, say from Andromeda, who picked this one up, would have a technology far enough advanced that they would recognize that this little gold disc was something that had to be played.
There are also instructions there. A lot of effort went into explaining this in a genuinely universal language, which is not easy to do. An arrow, for instance, won't work.
No, what do you do?
An arrow is a human thing.
We don't know how to write Andromedan, what do we say?
Well, you know, they don't even have to be Andromedans. There are 100 billion other stars in our own galaxy, so they may just be, we don't really know. Once the Voyagers get out there, the whole concept of travel changes quite a bit. What you have is just a kind of toy boat, and the stars are like vast, you know, aircraft carriers, and they go sailing by at their own rate of speed. So the very idea of going to a star becomes rather provincial out on that scale.
All the same, we're going to listen to what those who pick up the golden disc will hear if ever they do pick it up, and if ever they do follow our instructions to play it and hear the sound. There's some lovely music on there. And one is, of course, fascinated with the question of why was that music selected and what is it supposed to represent? I've got one favorite item. I've just been listening to that music this very day. And we shall play it and talk about the musical portion of this message to the stars right after we pause for this. We are poking about in, or we are reaching out toward, the universe tonight with Timothy Ferris and with Jim Manning. Before we listen to the music, I want to get on for just a moment, Jim. Tim mentioned earlier that there are some 100 billion stars, suns, in our own galaxy. And of course, there is, on average, we now estimate, I shouldn't say on average, but the proper estimate is about 100 billion galaxies out there, each on average with 100 billion stars. That's a lot of universe, isn't it?
Yes, it is. A whole lot. And what is the movie Contact said, if there isn't anybody else out there contemplating it, it's an awful waste of space.
It certainly is. And it's a shame that this record would then go to waste as well. At any rate, here's one of the selections, one that I listened to just today and quite loved. Well, there you are. Whether from Andromeda, from the Andromedan galaxy, or merely from a neighboring sun, if they hear that, they're going to really decide we're what? A spirited race.
Yes, yeah, a festive people on
festive
planet
people.
Earth.
Or would festivity, would it sound festive? It sounds festive to us, as it is. It's Mexican. It's a huaracho, I think. And it's wonderfully done. The guitars are strummed, not with the fingers, but with wooden
plectums,
plectums or whatever, yeah,
picks.
Which gives it part of that special sound. I love that stuff. But would it sound would it still sound festive? Is there a universality in what music communicates?
Well, we don't know. And, I mean, that's one of the reasons we put music on the Voyager record, is that it means a lot to us. But it doesn't have a particular message. If you want to send a message, then you just write it down or make a phone call. So we have no idea what music would mean to an alien intelligence, but we know that it's universally popular on Earth. And in putting the Voyager record together, we were very concerned to have music from around the world and try to hint at the tremendous variety of music on this planet.
As a matter of fact, if we can, I'm communicating now with my good friend Aubrey Mumpower, ace engineer. If we can go to the fourth one on that same disc. This is, explain what this is, in fact, if you would, Tim.
This is a field recording made years ago, decades ago, deep in the forests of Zaire, of the Turi people. And these are pygmy girls, just barely about 12 years old, 13 years old. Singing a song specific to that age. It's around, actually.
And once again, my guests tonight are Jim Manning, Executive Director of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, and Timothy Ferris, renowned journalist, both in print and in video, and the author of a number of fine books about space exploration and astronomical science, and of a new documentary coming up almost within, about a week or two?
Seeing in the Dark, which premieres on PBS on Wednesday, September 19th at 8 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is to expose people to stargazing, you know, rekindle their interest in the night sky, the extraordinary experience of looking through a telescope. And give them a website, if I can plug it, at pbs.org/seeinginthedark, where you can get all the tools you need to do some stargazing, starting with a star chart customized for your time and place.
That's how you started as a science aficionado, isn't it? That is, as an amateur kid astronomer.
Yeah, I started, got my first telescope 50 years ago, as of the day we started shooting the film, actually, at age 12. I think because of the beauty of the sky, just something about it. And, you know, I started reading books at the public library, and I began to realize that there's all this stuff out there and that we're part of it. There's no dividing line between the Earth and the wider universe. So if you want to understand where you are and who you are, it's all connected to the wider scheme of things. So I've been stargazing for half a century. And
I told you before the program started that my grandson has stolen the march on you. He's got his first telescope at the age of 10.
That's great to hear.
A serious telescope, and he's avidly scouring the heavens, sometimes calling me to tell me about his latest observations.
It's fantastic how kids can get into that. And, you know, once a child's interested in that subject, as with anything else, they just can learn at a speed that's far beyond what one could hope to teach them.
Now, we were talking about the musical selections that are on the Voyagers heading out there, possibly to be retrieved maybe this year, maybe a billion years from now, for all we know. Would they last a billion years?
They will. The record will last at least 1 billion years, and that's what ultimately would erode it is cosmic ray damage, and that's primarily on the outside of the record. So the inner side of the record lasts even more than a billion years, if a billion years isn't long enough. A billion years ago, life was just emerging from the seas onto dry land. So that a billion years is a long time.
So here's another item they will hear, those extraterrestrials, when they recover the object. You were saying earlier, this is from Zaire, Pygmy Girl's initiation song. They've got a nice harmonic structure to that thing.
It's very complicated. A lot of this music recorded in faraway times and places, people that have never had a concert hall or, you know, heard a recording of anything back in those days, were still producing this astonishingly complicated and subtle music, which in a way I think is something of a projection of how the human brain works. And in that sense, maybe putting music on the record does make sense.
Now, the Voyager Explorer operations went up, the two of them, in 1977. Thus, we're celebrating the 30th anniversary. 4 years before that, on this very program, Carl Sagan joined us one night, not for the first time. And we talked about extraterrestrial encounters, and here's what he had to say.
There's one question that's been on my mind through all this conversation. It's an indulgence of my own professional concerns and interests. There are social psychological implications, particularly in the question of what happens when we ultimately do make contact with some civilization at our own or at a higher level. We haven't done too well when bands of men, members of the same species, have suddenly come upon each other in a forest clearing. Indeed, bands of men called nations don't do too well these days in fully understanding each other and getting along in a cooperative, mutually satisfying way. What really might the consequences be when that contact is made, both in terms of how the contact will go, but also, of course, in terms of our own attitudes towards ourselves and the consequences for the further playing out of the drama of our own civilization.
It's a very deep question, and I can't pretend to have any definitive answers, but I'm glad to tell you what I think. Surely the history of our own species has been a very dismal one in this regard, and almost every time two societies meet and one is technologically just slightly more advanced than the other, the more advanced guys wipe out the less advanced guys, even though the less advanced guys may be better artistically or ethically or all sorts of other ways. And many people have a fear that that will happen when we make contact. I think that's unlikely for many reasons. One is that we cannot, at least in the next few centuries, pose a threat to anybody else, because the great distances between the stars provides a kind of natural quarantine. So I think it's certainly not an immediate problem.
They're safer on their side of the galaxy than we were in the old days on our side of the Atlantic.
Absolutely right. And another aspect of it is that I can... After all, the most likely contact mode is radio. So we have a big message, let's say. Let's say the Encyclopedia Galactica comes in. Well, we don't assimilate it right away. We have to understand it slowly. We have to test out each aspect of it to make sure we haven't misunderstood something. That's an enterprise of decades or centuries. That's not something that's going to happen right away. And it's kind of as if we just discovered... let's say, all of the literature of ancient Greece. We didn't know anything about them, and suddenly here was Aristotle and Plato and Archimedes and Euclid and Thucydides and Herodotus and those fellows. Well, we take a time for us to assimilate all that. It's one-way communication in time. We don't talk to Thucydides, but he talks to us. It would have a significant effect on our civilization, but slowly, at a rate that we could assimilate. And I think that's likely to be the case of successful interstellar contact. The final point I'd make is that once such contact were made, once it were clear that the alien civilization were very different from us, I think the differences among men would rapidly disappear, and the similarities between us, among us, would be entirely clear. I could see contact having a very unifying and positive consequence for men.
Well, I've got one.
Listening to that again, of course, I've heard it before, including when we originally had the conversation, but I'm suddenly reminded of the paper that William James did around the turn into the 20th century, titled The Moral Equivalent of War, in which he said one thing that would really unify the human race is if we encounter a civilization, he didn't say a civilization from elsewhere, but if we encounter a threat from elsewhere beyond this universe, or beyond this world, rather, that would unify mankind and end the scourge of war. And Carl is playing with that same thought there as well. That clip opens up the large question. It hangs over us. It has persisted through all these years of the modern era, where we've had a great new interest in space exploration, namely the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. They've been doing that for a number of decades now, and we have no evidence whatsoever, have we, Jim, that there's anything or anybody out there?
Not yet. It's all planet Venus, swamp gas, and quasars that we're discovering out there so far. So there's no evidence yet. Of course, the question that skeptics pose is if there are other civilizations out there who are presumably more advanced than us, wouldn't they already be here? And you can calculate it mathematically that if you have a sufficiently advanced civilization to begin to move out and colonize other stars or explore other stars, you should pretty much be able to cover the galaxy once you get started in a relatively short time in cosmic terms. So if they're out there, why ain't they here yet? And then you get all sorts of questions about, well, maybe they know about us, and there is this quarantine going on that Carl was talking about, that they're just the new kids on the block. We don't want to scare them, or we don't want to get involved with them. So there are all sorts of questions about if they're out there, why aren't they already contacting us, and why aren't we encountering them?
How widely are we scanning? I know that this is basically done through radio astronomy. Are we scanning all of the heavens?
Yes, in some ways. you can construct a what's called a phase space out of all the variables. What frequency do you listen to? Millions. Where do you listen? Well, in some cases, to the entire sky. How sensitive is your receiver? Well, the more narrower the piece of sky you look at, the more sensitive it will be, and so forth. The great gulf that's often overlooked in this subject is time. There could be quite a few civilizations in the history of the Milky Way galaxy, but if they don't typically last an enormously long period of time, meaning tens or hundreds of millions of years, then it's quite possible that they can all exist without ever coming in contact with one another. So time is really what you run into on this question, mm-hmm. as in so much of astronomy. Everything we see out there is in the past. You go out in the night and look up at the constellations, you're looking at light that is tens to hundreds, in some case thousands of years old. And radio signals are the same way. So it's a classic case of our just not knowing anything at all about it and trying to speculate on that basis. And naturally, one can only make limited progress that way.
Of course, SETI is one thing, and SETL is another. SETI is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETL would be the search for extraterrestrial life of lower order as well as at our level or above. And don't we have some scientists who claim that they have found life of a unicellular variety on Mars itself?
Well, there is one odd structure inside a Martian meteorite. This is a piece of Mars that got knocked off of Mars by an impact long ago and then happened to strike the Earth subsequently and was then discovered in Antarctica, where many meteorites are discovered because you can see them easily against the ice and snow. And this is still up in the air. There's some people looking at it think it's a natural structure. Others think that it might be a biological origin. Certainly a lot of good reasons to keep looking at Mars for signs of either life or the fossil evidence of life in the past. Another very good approach, which we're just starting to get into, is to orbit a telescope that is specifically designed to blot out the light from a star and look very closely for the light coming from planets. Planets are very close to the stars. You can't see them, mm-hmm. even with the biggest telescopes. But a life-bearing planet like the Earth, the way it reflects light reveals a chemical composition that's quite different from a planet that has no life. And so the first life discovered on another planet may be through analyzing the spectra of light from a planet circling another star.
Aren't they readying another major life-seeking experiment on the next Mars landing?
I believe so. Every time a Mars lander lands on Mars, you're going to be trying to do something to better characterize its capabilities.
When is the next one scheduled, actually?
The next Mars probe hasn't yet been launched. The launch windows for Mars come at about two-year intervals. Mm-hmm. The success rate at the Red Planet is only about 50%. It's not easy to land there. Craft have to land completely robotically because the light travel time is on already at least 15 minutes. So you can't control the craft. It has to land itself. And some of them have done very well, including the rovers that are there now and the earlier Viking project. Mars has been studied quite closely to resolutions down to about 10 meters, but it's a planet that used to be much more habitable for life than it is now. So if there's life there, the thinking is that it's down in at the liquid level below the permafrost. It's like looking for life under the permafrost.
And we have recently developed new evidence that there is a liquid level below the permafrost, and that. That was once, in a sense, a more watery planet than it presently is.
There's a lot of evidence historically, and then, astonishingly, just recently, the Mars orbiter photographs showed a slide that occurred on mm-hmm. a hillside on Mars that the geologists say almost certainly is caused by liquid water. It seems likely that, and to put it another way, Mars certainly was formed with water. And there's no known mechanism for getting the water off the planet once it's there. So presumably it's frozen, and it's tied up under the polar caps and in the polar caps.
So maybe there's an underground aquatic civilization on Mars itself.
Well, it's probably an aquifer. Whether there's a civilization there, I don't know.
Where are we going, and how fast are we going to get there in space itself?
I think that depends a lot on how much money is available, and that depends on how much political will there is to go. Certainly, there's the vision for space exploration, which is designed to get humans back on the moon and eventually on Mars. Scientifically, we've got Cassini going around Saturn. We've got new plans for Mars. We've got a new spacecraft headed for Mercury, one headed for Pluto. So we're doing scientific reconnaissance. How far we want to go depends on how far we want to go.
And those Explorer probes, as we've already established, are shortly going to be getting out of the sun's range and thus out of the sun's system, the solar system.
In the case of the Voyagers and Pioneer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is it conceivable that man could ever get that far out?
If he's got some free time, the distances are
well,
very great.
30 years.
Yes, and it would take as long for a human powered, perhaps a little longer, because the mass of the Voyager and Pioneer spacecraft is relatively small. If you've got a spacecraft that's massive enough to hold people, it requires a lot of energy to get it up to any sort of speed that can match
but
that of the
Voyagers. But science fiction anticipates the science to come and very often predicts correctly. Now, for years and years, we've had science fiction in which we've got a space exploration off into other galaxies, popping in and out of black holes as a way of speeding yourself along. In fact, I suddenly remember, do I not, Timothy, that you put a book together quite a number of years ago, written from the bridge of an intergalactic space operation.
There was a trope in a book I wrote called Galaxies that imagined interstellar space flight.
We even had a captain on it, as I remember. The equivalent of Captain Luke Picard.
Yes, it was a bit of a, you know, tongue-in-cheek, but it was meant to shift your perspective. I'm always interested in reminding my readers that these aren't just sight through a telescope. It's quite different if you get out there, and that shifting your perspective is a great way to understand what it's like back home. We don't know how to manage interstellar spacecraft as yet, but you know, the back in 1800, when the British had command of the oceans and marvelous sailing vessels, even they would have been hard-pressed to imagine, let's say, an aircraft carrier with a crew of 5,000 people running for 20 years without refueling all across the globe and commanding both the depths of the sea and the air above. And yet all that proved to be physically possible. So I'm an optimist about these things, as you are. It starts with human imagination. One of the difficulties the manned space program is stuck in now is that we're in a gap before private enterprise gets involved to a greater degree. So we're stuck with just federal programs. And federal programs are, the problem is they have to be so safe and so multi-layered that it is the most expensive way to send people into space.
How far away is the nearest star?
A little over 4 light years.
That's
the Alpha Centauri system.
The Alpha Centauri. So 4 light years away. So if you had a space vehicle that went at the speed of light, you can get there in 4 years.
That's right. And if you were traveling very close to the speed of light, the elapsed time on board would be much less than 4 years.
The Einstein paradox, which...
Yes, which isn't really a paradox, you know. So if you had a class of cosmonauts who were actually interstellar, at their 20th reunion, the hot shots who'd gotten the greatest deep space missions would actually be younger than the ones who'd been on the Milk Run.
Another reason for volunteering.
I didn't know. Is there a reason for volunteering?
Actually, you were scheduled to go up on one of the space shuttles, weren't you?
I was. There was a thing called the Journalist in Space program, which was scrubbed after the first space shuttle accident. I was going to write a book about it called Low Earth Orbit. And all that survives of that title now is the license plate on my car.
And once again, our guests for the evening are an old friend, Timothy Ferris, a new one, Jim Manning. Jim Manning is executive director of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. We've already determined that doesn't mean you're doing all your observations from a boat outside Los Angeles.
Correct.
It's a universal organization. To whom does it serve and in what way?
It's an interesting organization in that it began in 1889 and was designed to bring professional and amateur astronomers together. And for almost 120 years, we've sort of positioned ourselves at the intersection of all the major astronomical constituencies, the professional community, the education community, the enthusiast community, and increasingly the education and public outreach community, which is the main audience for the annual meeting that we will be having starting tomorrow evening.
Right here in Chicago.
Exactly.
Location?
At the Holiday Inn Mart Plaza.
And who is invited to come?
Education and public outreach professionals from around the country and around the world are invited to come in and share, learn from each other.
What is a public outreach professional? What does that mean?
Education and public outreach is sort of a relatively new term for an emerging group of people who are employed by NASA missions, by observatories, by NSF grant-funded projects. They're designed to take the science that's being produced and to communicate it to the various publics that they have in ways that are understandable, whether it's to teachers, to classes, to informal educators, such as those at museums or planetariums.
Well, Timothy Ferris has been doing something like that for 30 or 40 years.
And in fact, in 1986, Timothy was recipient of the Klumke Roberts Award of the ASP, which is designed specifically to recognize excellent activities in terms of popularization of science and education of science. So he's one of our alumni in a sense.
You're showing your new film at that meeting tomorrow, are you?
Yes, Seeing in the Dark will be screened at the meeting tomorrow evening prior to its PBS air date. And outreach is an important part of the film as well. Our website has a lot of stuff to help families and get into stargazing. And we have an internet telescope that will be available free to students across the country. Just send us an email, tell us an object you like an image of, and weather permitting, we'll take that image over the internet. It's all done remotely. No one ever has to touch the telescope, and email it back to you.
Ain't science wonderful?
I think that's amazing. I mean, if I'd had the choice going to you know, high school science class, whether to dissect a frog or see if I could discover a supernova in another galaxy, I think I'd be inclined to use the telescope.
Now, speaking of other galaxies and speaking about the whole universe, which is some 14 billion light years across.
In radius, yes.
In radius. Clearly, man, Homo sapiens, on space vessels will never get to the end of the universe. Or by the time he does, it will be more than 14 billion light years across, since it is an eternally expanding universe. However, we're still just talking about provincial matters. We're talking about just this one universe in which our puny little galaxy is lodged. And more recently, an idea that has come to dominate is that ours is one of a multitude of universes, possibly an infinity of universes. The mind dizzies just a bit considering the notion of an infinity of universes. But I want to play for you a conversation just from a few months ago with a well-known cosmologist, astrophysicist, Paul Davies. And after that, where we talk about these matters. Then after that, I want to get you talking about these matters, the multiverse, which may be out there. We're going to the question of, looking for an answer. Why is it just right for life? And part, one answer you entertained as well, but it's possibly one of many, many, many universes. So this one might be right, while all the other universes might be wrong.
Yes, this is a popular idea. It's become more popular in the last few years, and there seem to be some eminent cosmologists and physicists who are backing it.
Who's on that side of the picture?
Well, for example, Martin Rees, who's...
the British Astronomer Royal.
He's British Astronomer Royal, also president of the Royal Society, and incidentally master of Trinity College, which was Newton's college. And I often tell the story, I went to see him in the Master's Lodge there recently, and the lodge itself is about the size of a small Cambridge college. And I said, well, you know, did he have to keep house and keep the garden tidy? And he said his only duty was to wind Newton's clock. But Martin has been pushing the idea of this multiplicity of universes, the multiverse, for a long time. Leni Susskind at Stanford University is another very strong...
Who was on our program just a little while ago.
That's right. And his colleague there, Andre Lindy, has his own natural mechanism for generating these universes, which is called eternal inflation. And so has
Alex reminiscent of your old mentor, Fred Hoyle.
In one way, that is true. Yeah. If you take a sort of God's eye view in this eternal inflation theory, then what you see is that the superstructure of space is expanding frenetically fast. It's doubling in size in a tiny fraction of a second. a trillion of seconds to be precise. So you've got this overall expansion, and then here and there, bubbles, to use the term, nucleate out of this
and become universes.
And they become universes. Yeah. So the Big Bang was simply the nucleation of our bubble. I like to call it a Hubble bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And that there would be many other bubbles as well in other regions of space and time. And the bubbles are being conveyed apart faster than they're expanding, so they don't usually collide with each other. So we can't really ever see these other bubbles. We have to sort of infer.
If such a multiverse exists, there's no possibility that any universe can be in touch with any other universe.
There are variants where, in principle, that would be possible, but mostly the answer is not. So you have to accept this as a theoretical model only. And so that makes it very hard to test in any way that you can think of. There are certain statistical tests which might just pass muster. But otherwise, it really is an act of faith.
So how do we relate this back to the... How do we relate this back to the question with which your book is preempted?
Right, why is the universe just right for life? Doesn't help at all unless these other universes are going to be a bit different. And so the plan is that each universe comes with a slightly different set of laws. The universe over there might have slightly heavier electrons. The universe over there might have slightly stronger gravity and so on. And maybe that's just random. And then here and there, in this vast parameter space of possibilities, just by chance, all of the numbers come out just right. And in those universes, there's the potential for life. So it's no surprise we find ourselves in a universe which looks contrived. It looks like a put-up job, as Fred Hoyle said. Of course, we couldn't live in any of the others, any of the biohostile ones. So some people find that a satisfactory explanation. I think it goes partway to explaining what's going on, but it falls short of being a complete theory of existence. It's often presented as, well, therefore we've solved all the problems of existence, that's it. But it isn't it at all, because you still need a meta-theory to generate the universes. You still need to assume certain things like quantum physics. We've been talking about the nucleation of these bubbles, Big Bang bubble universes. That is a quantum process in the theory. So you need to assume quantum mechanics. You need to assume relativistic causality, that causes the normal idea of cause and effect and the speed of light being a barrier. All that has to be assumed. There's got to be mathematical laws of some sort to be distributed. So there's an awful lot of baggage that you still have to accept on faith in this multiverse theory. So it goes partway to explaining the universe, but it's certainly not a complete theory of existence. Far from it.
So there you are, Timothy Ferris and Jim Manning. Your assignment, if you choose to accept it, is simply settle this once and for all. Are there or are there not other universes?
I guess I'll say sure and no, because as was implied, there's no way to prove it one way or the other. I think part of it is that this universe, if there were slight changes to things like the universal constants, the fundamental masses of fundamental particles and laws and so on, our universe would not be the sort in which our kind of life could exist. Obviously it is, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here to know one way or the other. But it's almost like there can't be just one universe that is so finely tuned. So the way to sort of intellectualize that is, well, there must be a whole lot of petri dishes, and eventually one is going to hit upon the right combination of physical laws and fundamental constants and masses to produce us. But again, there's no way, since we can't really communicate or know if there are other universes out there, it's kind of an intellectual exercise from my standpoint. But it does bring into the whole notion of what's called the anthropic or anthropomorphic principle,
mm-hmm.
that the universe arose designed for us, that we are the inevitable end product of this universe. And part of it is how to deal with that in any sort of a scientific approach, because that seems more like a faith-based thing than a truly rigorous scientific thought.
Yes, in the anthropic principle, if you play it through all the way, there is the implication, though it's rarely spelled out directly, that if the universe was designed for us, there is a designer.
Correct. But if you've got a whole series of, an infinite series of petri dishes, and eventually, like, you know, if you get enough monkeys and typewriters together, somebody's going to produce Shakespeare, well, then maybe that's a way to scientifically indicate we exist, because there are a whole lots of other failed experiments out there. So one of them is bound to be right, and because we're in the right universe for us to arise, we can be aware of that fact.
But I thought that also the idea of the multiverse somehow was connected to, or is prompted by, speculations along the lines of string theory.
Yes, the reason scientists are talking about multiple universes is because the prospect keeps coming up as a kind of ghostly presence in theories that are very different otherwise. One of them that we just heard Paul Davies talking about is cosmology, the best known mechanism, the best theoretical mechanism for creating a universe, creates infinite numbers of them. It's a terrific mechanism, but it won't make just one universe for you. It wants to make a lot of them.
What is that mechanism?
That's what's called inflation, and Paul was talking about that. Inflation is very simple physical mechanism. It is the best candidate for explaining the Big Bang, but it very strongly implies that there are lots of universes. Now, at the very other end of the scale, down on the very smallest level, people, the string theorists who are trying to understand the ultimate foundation structure of matter, string theory keeps saying that that nature is built on more dimensions than the ones we see, that the real universe, so to speak, ought to be hyperdimensional, and that therefore
it posits either 11 or 13 dimensions, as I remember.
That's right, depending on the mathematics of the theory and so forth. And so what we see is only a small part of this theoretical hyperdimensional structure, which is exactly what you would expect if what Leonard Susskind at Stanford talks about as being a kind of landscape, a geometrical landscape built on hundreds or thousands or millions of dimensions, in which you have universes constructed in various dimensionalities. And 3+1 dimensional universes are probably the only ones really that can sustain life. It's almost inconceivable otherwise. But that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of sterile universes out there. There's also an avenue through quantum mechanics. I won't take your time on that. But it also implies additional universes. So it's not just thinking up fancy ideas. It's that several lines of research in science keep pointing to this, and when there are enough arrows pointing that way, we say, well, maybe we ought to take it seriously.
So do I hear the implication on this, Timothy, that you sort of lean in the direction of the likely reality of a multiverse?
I do. I wrote a book called The Whole Shebang, which essentially sets forth the multiple universe theories. I think that they're quite aside from the question of whether they're true or whether it's going to be possible to verify them. They're just healthy. They're a healthy way of looking at science. Let me give you one example. If there's only one universe, it's natural to assume that the fundamental laws of nature must be built on some deeper principle, which is sort of inevitable, that it couldn't be any other way. As Einstein put it, what I want to know is whether God had any choice in how he made the universe. Now, that's a fanciful way of saying something very important. Do the laws have to be the way they are? Again and again, you find strong indications that the answer to that is no, that the laws of nature in our universe are not due to some inevitability, that they could be quite different. And from that, it's a short step to saying, well, maybe they are quite different in other places.
So Newtonian mechanics might not describe at all how billiard balls move on a pool table in some other universe.
That's right. I mean, they already, Newtonian mechanics already breaks down for a billiard table in the vicinity of a black hole, for instance. And the laws could very easily be different in other universes. Whether that can ever be confirmed is an open question, but it's a fascinating subject, and it's real science. It's not just wool gathering.
All of our lines were filled a few minutes ago, and if you've been trying to reach us, you've been hitting the busy signal. But frankly, on a program like this, not everybody makes the cut. And so we've now got two lines available again, 591-7200, the number. If you want to get on the air to pose your question or comment, move quickly, 591-7200. And here is the first call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Milt. You know, I've listened to you for years. You never fail to have a really entertaining show. Really, congratulations. Whoever picks your guest does a wonderful job.
Well, thank you, sir.
The conversation is very stimulating and very deep, and I am reminded of one of my favorite stories. It has to do with Carl Sagan. In fact, it's credited to Carl Sagan. And it has to do with the selection of the material that went on that disk into deep space. And there were a lot of people involved in bringing, when it was decided to do that, there were several people involved in making choices about...
Well, Tim Ferriss, our guest tonight, was one of them.
Well, then maybe he can tell me if this is a true story. Evidently, a lot of people contributed ideas about various kinds of music, and there were the obligatory nods to eclectic things like the two wonderful pieces that you played, and then, you know, Mozart or Chopin or whoever.
Yes.
And at the end of the whole thing, evidently Sagan noticed or remarked that there was no rock and roll on the disc, and he lobbied and successfully got Johnny B. Good by Chuck Berry a place on the disc.
Well, Johnny B. Good is on the record.
And Sagan supposedly told the story that he imagined someday in the near or not so near future that one of these listening devices that we have all around the world would pick up a response from outer space, and it would go something like, "Hey, we got your record last night. Played it after dinner. Absolutely loved it. Do us a favor. Send more Chuck Berry."
Well, that the punchline is correct. Let me quickly unpack the story. It wasn't Carl who lobbied for Chuck Berry. He actually didn't like the record when we first played it for him. It was Andrian and I who were insisted that there ought to be rock music on it.
Well, congratulations.
Thanks. And and Carl did come around and actually did defend it. One of the members of the committee that selected the music didn't think it ought to be included and said it called it adolescent. And Carl said, I thought it was a brilliant comment, said, "Well, you know, there are a lot of adolescents on this planet, too."
Yeah.
The punchline comes from a Saturday Night Live routine.
Oh, it does. The way I heard the story was that it was actually, you know, Carl kind of telling the story on himself. But, you know, those things do get distorted into retelling.
That's known as serial elaboration. We thank you, sir, for the call.
Thanks very much, Matt.
And
thank you.
We'll go quickly to another on 591-7200. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. I have, multiple questions. First, about the meaning of the word universe. Universe used to mean universal everything. In other words, by definition, it includes everything that is. To talk about more than one universe is to change the meaning of universe.
When scientists say universe, they mean the set of all phenomena that are currently or in the future potentially observable. So when you talk about multiple universes, you mean that they exist, but that they are not observable, at least in the foreseeable future.
I love the Cambridge philosopher's definition of universe. The universe is everything that is the case.
Yes, that's right. Everything that's the case rather than that is false or invented. So you don't have to change the definition exactly, but you're quite right that the popular term, it wouldn't make sense in popular lingo.
And as we go back to the phones, I will request of my good friend Aubrey Mumpower, who's running the record player, as we used to call it, the very first thing on disc one. This is what leads the musical selection for the extraterrestrials who may eventually pick up the golden disc. And it is number one on disc one. I won't define it, but we'll hear it in just a moment, I trust. If not, we'll go to the next call and then we'll hear it. Now, that is indeed fascinating music. Well, I listened to this earlier today because your people sent over all the musical selections, but they didn't identify them. I knew that was something liturgical in the Orthodox Church. But that was as much as I knew.
It's a chorus called Chakrulo, and perhaps the Russophone listeners will correct my pronunciation on that. It's a chorus in Georgia, which was the Georgian Socialist Soviet Republic at the time this recording was made by a field unit from Radio Moscow. And we put on the record what we believe is the only copy outside of Russia in the world at that time, which was loaned to us by Alan Lomax, the great ethnomusicologist.
Fascinating music. Good music.
I think so. Our goal, you know, we wanted to make a good record and not just a not a piece of committee work, and I think we did that.
We go back to the phones now, 591-7200. After I read you one particular email that I've got here and get your response to it, I understand that Voyager is slowly losing power and will eventually shut down completely around the year 2020. What sensors or instruments will still be functional, and what information will Voyager be able to provide to us in its final years?
Anything it can. When it runs out of power and can't signal back, then it's done.
That's it. It's a plutonium power source, and the writer is quite correct that it'll start to falter if everything else continues to work around the year 2020. So once that happens, Voyager will fade out and it'll cease to function.
What kind of information is the sending back now?
Cosmic rays, magnetic fields, other sorts of particle information, things that are very useful in mapping that sheath that surrounds the solar system.
So hopefully it'll hit that heliopause, the heliosphere, before then.
Yeah, there you go. It's a close call, but I'm betting on the spacecraft. Plus, keep in mind, there are two of them.
Yeah. And we go back to the phones now, 591-7200. Good evening.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I had a question. You know, they're starting to discover all these planets that are sort of nearby that possibly may have life and all that. And I was kind of wondering if they're starting to maybe point a lot of the electronics towards these places. And if they are, is it possible that maybe there might be life for, you know, industrial world over there, and they've got a totally different type of system?
Well, sir, you started with a basic incorrect assumption. You say that we have some evidence that there is probably life in some of the planets nearby. We have no evidence of that sort at all, though we wish for it.
No, not yet. It's hoped that with telescopes like the James Webb Space Telescope, which is slated to go up in a couple of years, 2013 or so, that it may, with its infrared capabilities, be able to detect the sorts of things Tim was talking about, evidence that the planet has life. If you can detect things like oxygen in the atmosphere, which is in our atmosphere because life, plants, bacteria, breathe into the atmosphere, you might be able to get some sense that there is life on these planets. But the technology still have to be developed to be able to do that. They still have to go up.
Here's an interesting question that occurs to me, reverting to my own interest as a psychologist. Why we are all rooting for life elsewhere. Why do we so much want or need to find life elsewhere?
I think it'd be much more interesting. The caller, I believe, is referring, and as he said, that there, you know, planets on which there could conceivably be life, to the fact that planets have now been found, indirect evidence been found of planets orbiting more than 200 stars in the vicinity of the sun. So that was one big obstacle. Back when the SETI project started, it was completely theoretical.
We had then no evidence that any other planets beyond our solar system existed.
Only indirect evidence having to do with the spin rate of stars. So that's a big step that's been taken. And to answer the caller's question, I'm not sure that SETI has tried to target specifically stars that have planets, but those stars are so nearby that they would have been included in early searches. Anyhow, but it is fascinating to start thinking about. Just to give you one example of our little galaxy, if you had an atlas of every planetary system in our galaxy, so one page was the solar system, the next page was another star with planets, and all you did was page through that thing looking at those pages, it would take you over 1,000 years just to look at each page once.
Well, which is another way of saying what you said earlier, that there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy.
Yeah, that's so there's astronomers are never going to go out of work.
The Holy Grail, though, is to find extrasolar planets that are that seem to be Earth-like, that are of the right mass, the right size. And the Kepler spacecraft, which will be going up in a few years, is designed to look for those sorts of planets that transit across the disks of stars. And so when we begin to find planets that, at least in size and orbit, begin to resemble ours, those will be really targeted to see if we can detect by various means whether or not they may have some evidence for some kind of life process.
How did the guys, whether commanded by Captain Kirk or by Captain Picard on the Starship Enterprise, do so well in finding such planets?
It's a good question. You know, one interesting thing in this film, Seeing in the Dark, that we were dealing with is that there are now amateur astronomers who, with backyard telescopes, can detect planets transiting across the face of other stars. So it's now possible that an amateur astronomer will discover a planet, which is something that hasn't happened since William Herschel did it in the 18th century.
Which one did he find?
Uranus.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. It's time to pause for a last round of commercials, then right back to the phones and to the email. 591-7200, the number for email extension 720 at tribune.com. With a quick word for ourselves, that is a quick commercial for ourselves, namely to direct you once again to our program blog. It's called Milt's File, and the full handle is miltsfile.com, of course, where we put up stuff that we find in the some of the distant newspapers from elsewhere in the world and from scientific and political and opinion journals from all over the world, and yet other even more esoteric sources. And it's all available to you at miltsfile.com. An interesting selection went up just a few days ago. Another will go up tomorrow, as a matter of fact. You get there instantly. You can do it right after this program. miltsfile.com. And now back to the phones. And here is the next caller. Good evening.
Yes, good evening.
Yes, sir.
I would have no objection to almost any genre that we would send out, except that I wouldn't want the selection to be either misogynistic or racist. We must be careful about that. Other than that, I wanted to ask about time travel and physiological change. I can believe that through going faster than the speed of light, we might accelerate or decelerate time. We might reshape it. But I always wonder when I hear about coming back younger than you were before, I wonder about what processes that would accomplish that.
Well, I don't think you come back younger. You come back less aged than those you left behind, isn't that right?
Right. When you're traveling at near the speed of light, time will seem to, if people back home could look at the clocks on your ship, time would be traveling just fine as far as you could tell on your ship, but it would look like time was slowing down the faster you travel to someone who was outside of your frame of reference in your back home. So it would seem that you would age more slowly than, and in fact, as Tim was saying earlier, it's a mathematical truth. It's when you work out the, and in fact, even insofar as Einstein's theory of time dilation, as it's called, has been testable, it's passed those tests.
Well, you see it all the time. You see time dilation in the expanding universe. It's used every day in particle accelerators. So it's a fact on it.
Our thanks to the caller. Quickly to another on 591-7200. Good evening.
Yes, I disagree with the current theory on the initial background radiation from the Big Bang.
You disagree in what way?
The astronomers say that the radiation started approximately 1 million years after the Big Bang, and the heat began radiating out. So, it seems that the heat should have radiated completely out of the our universe after 2 million years.
What happens in about 1 million years is that the material in the universe thins out sufficiently that an average photon of light will, as it travels through space, will not immediately hit another object. So you get a kind of it's like a clearing fog. That's what releases the cosmic background radiation is high energy photons. It's not heat.
Well, heat is photons and heat are the same, right?
Well, if you're talking about infrared light, yes. But the all of this happens inside the universe. A particle can't walk out of the universe. Every direction it can.
Let us remember that same definition of the universe that I offered a moment ago. The universe is everything that is the case. A photon remains.
Yeah, the photon. The cosmic background radiation is everywhere in the sky, and that's one way to help realize how the universe is put together, that space and time are bound in one continuum, and every observer in the universe sees the early universe off at a distance of more than 10 billion light years. There isn't any center to it. Anywhere you go in the universe, you see the same picture.
And we go to the next call on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Mel. Good show.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with my girlfriend about things related to this, and she mentioned how ridiculous it would be to assume that any extraterrestrial being would look like us or even be able to communicate with us, that what we see in the movies is just there to appease the science fiction buffs and the viewers so they have something to relate to and something to hang on to.
Well, the alien forms in representation in film or TV always have the same sorts of limbs, but they have strange scaly skins or other alterations of their facial features.
Well, because it's much more expensive to make to do something other than put an actor in a suit.
But I remember a wonderful speculation by our old mutual friend Carl Sagan. You remember this? It was in his Cosmos series where they speculate about the life forms on Mars, and there are some that are floating in air and never land and so on.
Yes, and Carl used to talk about that on Jupiter, too. You know, Jupiter,
oh, that was Jupiter,
this,
I guess.
It has this very deep atmosphere with a wide variety of different sources. But if you ask what do you really need for life, you essentially need some kind of an energy differential. That is, you need an energy source, but also a place where it drops off so you can make work out of that. That's thermodynamics. You need information, which is DNA, and you need some kind of nutrient. And Jupiter does have all those. So Carl used to talk about sort of creatures like jellyfish floating in the atmosphere of Jupiter, and that kind of imaginative thinking is very helpful. I'm not so sure, however, that it would be impossible to communicate with an intelligent extraterrestrial. A being might look and behave and in many ways be different from us. But, you know, if you've got 10 planets, that's something you can communicate.
The language of mathematics should be universal throughout the universe if you're dealing with a sufficiently advanced species.
Gee, that comes close to Plato, actually, who argues that mathematics is ultimate reality and exists because it is reality, and we approximate as we approach it.
Well, the laws of physics should be universal throughout the universe, and so gravity is what gravity is. When you get in your black holes, things get really, really funky, really
fast.
And
we've already established that in other universes, if there are any, the laws of physics might be different.
Mm-hmm. But they would be the same within that universe. So again, there'd be a common vocabulary that different species could potentially use.
We go quickly to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes, I wanted to pose a question, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to notice this, but that the similarity between the structure of an atom and the solar system, if it's possible for an atom to almost be a solar system, but at a much greater rate of time, and also that you talked about multiple universes, is it possible for a universe to be a building block of another universe?
Well, sure. In hyperdimensional constructs, a lot of things can happen. In quantum mechanics, there are some theories in which, and also in cosmology too, from the other end of the scale, there are theories in which the next universe over is less than 1 centimeter from here. Thinking about it is a good way to start thinking about higher dimensions. It can't, according to this one theory, which is a school of theories called brain theory. In brain theory, the next universe can't be as much as 1 centimeter away. So it's kind of fascinating. The atom part, when the atoms were structure of the atom was first discovered, it was thought that it looked like a solar system, but unfortunately, it soon turned out not to be the case. It's just unfortunately a superficial resemblance.
All right, thanks to the caller. We are approaching the end of the available time. And I want to end with some music, again, from the great golden disc. But before that, what's really happening these days in astronomical and astrophysical work that is especially exciting?
Oh, goodness. I think we've been talking about a lot of the things that are exciting. We're beginning to really understand and be able to characterize the universe in ways that we never have been before. With missions like WMAP, where we can know whether the universe is open, closed, or sort of flat, exactly how old the universe is. We're beginning to get the technologies and tools to really understand in a way we never have before what the universe is really like. And that's very exciting.
Tim.
It's a synergy of a lot of different approaches. We just here in this country alone have invested for many decades now, more than a century, in a lot of fancy telescopes and detectors, and it's paid off. We've learned more about the universe in that century than in all of prior human history combined. So our children are growing up, going to school, knowing much, much more about where they live and where the other places are. Our species has become a lot less provincial. So it's really a great investment that we've made. We spend enough in this country to have really opened up astonishing frontiers in science, and I'm happy to say that we show every sign that we're going to keep doing it.
As we close down for the evening, one last selection from the Golden Disc. It's a very beautiful non-vocal blues performance. Dark Was the Night, written and performed by Blind Willie Johnson. Say something about this.
This is a field recording by a man who was, Blind Willie Johnson, was homeless much of the time. He died of pneumonia after the shack he was living in burned, and he had to stay on the frame of it in the rain. We put it on the Voyager record, and it's the basis of the theme song of my film, Seeing in the Dark, where Mark Knopfler has reinterpreted it. It's, I think, one of the great lasting pieces of American folk music of all time.
And there it is behind us as we wind down for the evening. With thanks to our two guests of the evening, Jim Manning, Executive Director of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, and Timothy Ferris, man of all work when it comes to valuable scientific popularization, particularly as regards astronomy, astrophysics, and cosmology. Author of and director and general creator of the new film, Seeing in the Dark. And with that, we'll let you listen to the music as we go. We'll be with you again on, I believe, Thursday night.
Ah.